KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and thank you for listening today. Today I'm very excited to have on the author of a fascinating history called The Secret History of Science's Postwar Elite, and the title is The Jasons. The author is Anne Finkbeiner. Anne is a freelance science writer who writes about cosmology and who runs the graduate program in science writing at Johns Hopkins University. The book covers a topic which I can say has very little to do with a lot of the topics that we've discussed on this show, except for one. This is a history that focuses on a very secretive and largely unknown group of scientists called the Jasons. And I will let Anne describe who the Jasons are and what they were about. But what it boils down to is a book focusing on various projects that groups of scientists perform for the United States government starting in the post-World War II era. And Anne's book is a fascinating compendium and a chronology of events based upon the information that she could gather dealing with this secret organization called the Jasons. The book is interesting for a number of reasons aside from the fascinating history. It's also a great way to consider how science and technology interact in the on the practical side of operations of government and indeed in world affairs. And what you find in reading through Anne's book is a regular theme of the moral quandaries and the ethical issues that scientists have to face as they perform duties for government and as they create and invent technologies that may have uses far beyond or different than the scientists originally conceived. And the challenge for scientists focusing on these issues is really to decide, A, whether they want to do the research in the first place, and secondly, whether they want to participate in its practical applications. And one of the very interesting issues that we'll be discussing today with Anne borders and really touches on that very question. We will take a look closely and discuss in the time that we have some of the quandaries that the Jasons faced. We talk a bit about their history and really look at where science is based upon this story. I should emphasize that one of the other challenges about this, about discussing this book, and indeed a challenge that we'll explore a little bit with Anne, is that the topic itself is shrouded in secrecy. And as Anne points out in her introduction to the book, one of the major challenges here was simply getting people to talk to her about this organization. So certainly Anne as an author was, by that constraint alone, limited in the amount of information she could gather. But it also means that the conversation will be somewhat limited because we don't have a complete record of who the Jasons are, what they're doing. But Anne has clearly written the definitive work on the topic, and one that is really fascinating and very readable chronology of these events. As if I've done my job correctly, on the other end of the line is Anne. Anne, are you there?
I am.
Terrific. Thank you for taking the time today to come on Hearsay Culture and discuss your book.
Well, it's I'm looking forward to the discussion. I think we're going to have fun.
Terrific. Well, let's dive right in and really ask the first question which sets the stage, which is Jason. What does it mean and why did you write this book?
Well, Jason doesn't actually mean anything. But first of all, I'll tell you why I wrote the book.
There we go. Then we'll get to the meaning or what the word is.
Right. I wrote the book because I'll back up a little minute. My husband was a physicist at Johns Hopkins University, and he had a. Are you still there?
I am.
Okay. All right. Sorry,
that's okay.
The sound change. Okay, so there was this eminent guest that came and gave a talk, and it was Freeman Dyson. And afterwards, everyone took Dyson out to dinner, and Dyson is a great storyteller, and he was telling these stories at dinner, and one of them was about crawling around on the Mexican border looking for the infrared signatures of drug runners. And I could not picture Dyson doing that because he's a fragile-looking man, and not all that young. And so I asked him why he was doing it, and he said, well, it was a Jason study, and I asked him what was Jason, and he didn't really answer it, and you know what happens when people don't answer questions they
right.
want to know the answer to. So I started asking around, and I found out a whole bunch of stuff that I didn't particularly believe. Some of it was true, and some of it wasn't. But what I found out that turned out to be true is that Jason is a group of about, oh, say 30 to 40 people. Started out being physicists. Now it's a lot of different kinds of scientists, but they're all really pretty much hotshot scientists. And they spend their university scientists, and they spend their summers, instead of doing their research, they're spending it 6 weeks, answering questions often for the Defense Department.
And these are, the origin of the name is kind of an interesting setting for what the organization is about. And you float several theories that were discussed, but then you definitively answered a question. So, Jason, what is the name connote? Where did that come from?
Well, the standard thing that you always hear is it stands for July, August, September, October, November, which is supposedly the months that they do their studies. They don't begin to do studies that are that long. So, and it's silly anyway. And another one was that it actually stands for junior advisors, somewhat older now. I don't know who made that joke up, but the Jasons tell it themselves. And another story was that one of the founders had a dog named Jason, and he named the group after his dog, but it turns out the dog's name was not Jason, it was Jack. So none of those stories are true. The true story is this, and I alone have published this. This is a scoop.
Congratulations, yeah.
The true story is that this founder, whose name is Murph Goldberger, went to one of the founding meetings, and ARPA, the Advanced Research Projects Agency in the Defense Department, was sort of sponsoring Jason at the time. And they had a little computer that just spit out names, you know, project this, project that. And they decided to call this new group Project Sunrise. And Murph took that back to the Jasons, and they didn't much like it. They thought it sounded like a super bomb, and that's not what they were doing. And they didn't feel like a sunrise. And so he took it home to his wife, Mildred, and told her about it, and she said, that's really a dumb name. And he said, if you're so smart, what's a better one? And she had just been looking at a brochure that had a Greek temple on it. And so she just said, Jason. And it meant, you know, Jason and the Argonauts. And so I asked her what was in her mind when she said that. And this is her actual sentence, which I love. She said, well, Jason wouldn't be thought of, Jason, no, I'm sorry, I'm going to start over again. She said, Jason would be thought of as young heroes. She said, Jason wasn't going to be a bunch of middle-aged men smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee. Jason would be a tall, well-muscled, blonde hero. So I think that's a name of love.
Yeah, certainly that's a surprising derivation of the name of such a seriously minded organization.
That's right. It's all well-muscled blondes.
Right.
I don't think there's a whole lot of them in there, actually.
Yeah, from certainly the people you described, especially its inception, that wasn't my conception of Robert Oppenheimer and many of the others. It's interesting. Now, before we get into the details of Jason itself as an organization, and in fact its structure, which I understand from your book is rather loose, I want to just touch on the secrecy issue which you confronted in writing this book. Just if you could talk a little bit about that challenge, because your introduction kind of laid the framework for what Jason is, and the fact that you had a number of Jasons, as you call them, who are reticent to speak, kind of speaks volumes itself about what this organization is. So maybe you could describe those challenges in a couple of minutes.
Sure. First, I have to say that scientists, I'm a science writer, used to interviewing scientists love to talk. they'll just tell you every single thing they know, and then they'll make sure you understand it by telling you again. So I wasn't used to this. This surprised me. But the reasons for it were, number one, a lot of what they do, more than half, is classified. And because they are natively talky people, they are very, very careful. They're probably more careful than people who are used to working around classified material about you know, just being very close-mouthed about the whole subject. The other reason for their secrecy, especially with the older guys, is that they were what they call outed during the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a heck of a time for an academic to be seen to be working with the military. So when they, you know, on their campuses, they were called, considered war criminals.
Mm-hmm.
And working with the military still isn't popular on university campuses. It's still not seen as a, you know, a really zippy thing to do.
Right.
And also, if you're a government advisor, you don't go around talking about what advice you're giving, especially if you're advising the executive branch.
Mm-hmm.
You just kind of, that's a political rule, and you follow the political rules when you're in that world.
And I think you do make reference to the fact that the book itself, because of the fact that you don't have complete and total access to public records and things like that, is more a compendium of stories that you put together as a chronology.
Yeah, exactly.
And it makes for great reading, and I want to get into some of those stories now. The purpose of Jason, what is it, and has it changed in its 50-odd year history?
You know, I've been thinking about that. They have always, you know, most scientists feel this very strongly. They want national security programs and policy to be based on science. You know, when the programs or policy involve science, they want the science to be real. So if you've got, you know, ballistic missile defense, they want, which is basically just physics, they want the physics to be real in it. And so they have always been against ballistic missiles. Not bullet, but these, you know, missiles that can hit other missiles in the middle of the air.
Mm-hmm.
Their central mission, though, has always been, well, I'm not going to say their central mission. A big mission throughout their whole life has been to stop nuclear proliferation. And an awful lot of the policy that lets countries sign test ban treaties and go after, you know, look for weapons of mass destruction. A lot of that is just physics, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so they do an awful lot of that science. Always have, and they still do. And now, of course, they're also interested in terrorism questions, which is an entirely different set of questions.
Right, and you mentioned towards the end of the book that the organization itself, historically, and I'll ask about its initial members in a moment, but was founded basically by physicists, and its most recent members are now biologists, which is kind of an ominous state of where we are in terms of defense and military concerns.
Yeah, there's that. It's a sort of a little catchphrase that World War I was the chemist's war, and World War II was the physicist's war, and the punchline of that little thing is World War III will be the biologist's war. And, you know, ick.
Yeah. Yeah, there's really, it's almost, I can almost say thank you for everything, and and we could end on what would clearly be the darkest note possible for the show. But it is a very scary process, and it lends itself to really, I think, what are some of the real quandaries that the Jasons face and what you lay out in the book. And I want to get into those. Before we do, so that the listeners understand who the Jasons are, if you could talk a little bit about its initial members and some of its current membership and who those people are and where they're situated.
Okay.
To the extent, of course, that
sure,
we can know these things and that you can speak about them.
Right. Anybody who's who I interviewed, who, let me use their name in the book, I feel free to talk about. The first, sort of the core members were physicists, Murf Goldberger at Princeton, Ken Watson, who was then at Wisconsin, and Keith Bruckner, who moved to San Diego. I have these guys' careers in my head, and I can't remember where they ended up.
Mm-hmm.
But right in the first group were a bunch of Stanford guys, and that included Pete Panofsky and Bert Richter and Sid Drell.
Mm-hmm.
How could I forget Sid Drell?
So it ran the range in academia across the United States.
Yes. Oh yeah. Like a lot of science, it tends to be bi-coastal, but yeah.
Right. And to the extent, again, possible, its current membership is more diverse, both in terms of their disciplines, and also you mentioned that used to be all men, and now there are some women involved, and so it's kind of expanded its horizons in that sense.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Now they've got chemists, oceanographers, mathematicians, computer scientists, engineers, biologists, and a few women. Not half.
Right. But more than zero.
More than zero. Yeah. Probably, but probably like 10%.
Right.
They could probably do better on the women issue.
Right. Well, let's get into with those kind of antecedents. Let's dive into some of this history. And you start off the book, and of course, in the limited time we have, I can't touch on the number of fascinating stories that you tell and what their ramifications might be. But it does make sense to start with the inception. And the interesting thing that I noted immediately was that Jason came out of ARPA, or what's now known as DARPA, but the Defense Department agency that's also credited, as well it should be, for being, you know, one of the major antecedents of the Internet and the creators of it. And I'm curious to know, when you look at this history and the involvement of DARPA, how much involvement or how much credit can they be given for forming Jason?
They didn't form Jason.
Okay.
They were just sort of its first home. This might be worth talking about for a minute. Mm-hmm. Jason is an oddly unique and independent little entity. It's just itself. It contracts through, or it did at the time, contract through what was then ARPA. And, in fact, for a long time, because ARPA is what it is, the kind of agency it is, its motto is high risk, high payoff. ARPA and Jason were a very good match, and ARPA was Jason's sole sponsor, was the only part of the government that asked Jason questions.
Hmm.
So Jason studies followed ARPA's preoccupation at the beginning, which was, of course, missile defense and nuclear proliferation. There were those two big Cold War issues, and that was just about it.
Hmm. I probably should have delved a little more deeply into this initially. So Jason is an organization, and you do touch on this in the book, that has, to a certain degree, a selection process for the projects it's going to take on, as well as for who will be a member.
Exactly. Jason chooses what studies it's going to do. The Defense Department, Department of Energy, can ask it questions, but Jason chooses what it's going to work on. And the individual Jason, so once Jason says, yeah, we'll have a study on that, then the individual Jasons can say, I'd like to work on it, I don't want to work on it, and it's fine. The Jason chooses its own members. Nobody tells Jason what to do. And in fact, ARPA's most recent avatar, which is DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, they just keep changing their name, In 2002, fired Jason because DARPA had asked Jason to include three members that it probably, it was something, I've never gotten, I have a believable story about it. I haven't a clue what the true story is. But the believable story is that you know, somebody in the Defense Department wanted to do a favor for some political friends and said and suggested that these guys be on Jason. And Jason said they'd look into them and then said no, they didn't quite meet their criteria, and DARPA fired Jason. DARPA does not sponsor Jason.
So what? Where is it today as we
it
speak?
It actually went to DARPA's boss. In the defense hierarchy, which is an office called the Directorate of Defense Research and Engineering. That office stands between the Secretary of Defense and DARPA.
So could
they
that
actually bumped up one?
Yeah, I was about to say, could that be viewed as a promotion for Jason?
Sort of. I don't think it really needs a promotion.
Right.
I mean, it's just independent. Mm-hmm. So where it actually sits hierarchy probably isn't all that important.
Well, I think that segues into the next point I want to go into, which is something which people will obviously be wondering about, which is what exactly does Jason do? And I want to compare two stories that you tell in the book about two projects that Jason developed. The first is the electronic battlefield. And compare that with the report that they developed to basically, in effect, convince the Defense Department that using nuclear weapons in Vietnam would not be a successful strategy. In your book, you describe the electronic battlefield story as a perversion of the original work that Jason was doing to basically of a defensive nature to allow for detection of troops and what have you, and that it became something that was used in an offensive way in a war. Offense as opposed to defense, as opposed to something that people would be bothered by, although they might be. The latter, you argue, helped prevent the use of weapons in Vietnam that would, in Jason's opinion, and I'm sure history would bear it out, would not have been a good idea. I'd like you to describe that comparison, and then my question really boils down to, on balance, how much of Jason's work has been used for the purposes that Jason intended, and how much is not, to the extent you can tell?
Okay, is that a complicated question.
And if you can answer it in 2 minutes, that would
be great. Yes, I can.
Welcome to radio.
Well, in the first place, you've got the general stories correct, but you've got the details wrong.
Okay.
The thing that Jason, during the Vietnam War, was very upset about the wholesale bombing of the North that we were doing. It wasn't doing any good at all. And so Jason came up with a way to what it thought of as dampen down the war. That was the phrase it used. And what it was the war was being supplied. The North was sort of infiltrating the South. It was supplying an insurgency in the South. And the supply trains came down over the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And so Jason thought if they could put a bunch of sensors, acoustic sensors, magnetic sensors, chemical sensors, infrared sensors, sprinkle them along the trail, and if when a sensor was triggered, it radioed an airplane that was orbiting over the trail, and then that airplane would orbit a big fancy state-of-the-art computer up in Thailand, and then the fancy state-of-the-art computer could say exactly where those sensors were that were being triggered and decide if they were, you know, a herd of cows or a battalion of troops or a bunch of trucks. Then they could call the Air Force and say, go bomb those guys if they were bad guys and not cows. That actually worked. I mean, it sounds like a cockamamie idea to me, but it really worked. It happened from sensor to bomber was minutes, like 5 minutes.
Hmm.
This is astounding. Now, what the Jasons had in mind with that was that it would slow infiltration enough that we could slow the bombing of the North enough that we could get North Vietnam to a negotiating table. That was their nice little idea about what that might do. The military, of course, saw a great way of finding out where the enemy is and bombing him. And, in fact, the military took that system and set it up around Khe Sanh, which was a marine base which was being sieged and probably would have been wiped out. There had been a previous base in a previous war that was wiped out in exactly the same way this one was happening. That Khe Sanh. And because of putting the sensors around there, they knew where to bomb and where to aim the artillery, and the Marines got out of Khe Sanh. So then it was just used very widely throughout Vietnam to sort of prosecute the war, not dampen it down, but to prosecute it. And that got the Jasons. The other study they did was a study that nobody asked for on whether or not it would be a good idea to use nuclear weapons in Vietnam. The Jasons heard at one of their receptions, overheard somebody talking about dropping a few nukes on a pass, on a mountain pass, what a good idea that would be, and got alarmed and did this study, and one of the guys who did it actually was Freeman Dyson, the first guy who got me interested, and found that nuclear weapons in Vietnam would be counterproductive. Assuming that we would use them, then we can assume that China and Russia would use them, and our bases were much more sitting ducks than anything that we could bomb with nuclear weapons in Vietnam. So the thing was, nobody had asked for that study, and nobody was interested in it. It probably did no good at all, which is kind of sad. I mean, it's hard to say whether it did any good, but it probably did not.
I see.
But what the Jasons say is that the authors of the study have to be sort of plugged into the right networks in Washington. And these guys that did the study were not plugged in. They say so.
It brings me to, and we'll take a short music break, but when we return, it brings me to kind of the more, slightly more abstract discussion that I want to have on secrecy and the, both secrecy in government, but also secrecy in the scientific endeavor. And you devote quite a bit of time in the book, discussing those issues and how the Jasons, confronted them. So.
Before we return with Ann Finkbeiner, I wanted to ask you if you love what you're listening to right now, and I hope you do. If you do, and regardless if you do, but you like something on KZSU, please help KZSU maintain its excellent programming. KZSU is a non-commercial radio station that depends on the support of its listeners to continue broadcasting its diverse range of music, shows, sporting events, news, and hearsay culture. By visiting www.stanford.kzsu.edu or clicking on Donate to KZSU, you can do your part to make sure our independent sound never dies. You can also write to KZSU at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. So we're back with Ann Finkbeiner, author of the book The Jasons. And Ann, what I want to turn to now, and in the time that we have left, is really look at the issue of secrecy. You have a sentence in your book which says secrecy is anti-science. And I'm curious to get your reaction to that, because it seems like, in at least in modern society, where we have public-private partnerships and government and industry working together, the government or industry funding scientific research, that secrecy seems to be much more of the norm than it was, say, when the Jasons first came about as an organization. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I'm not sure if it's true or not. some of the first Jasons had started out working with the government by consulting for Convair. So, and they were consulting, in fact, I think probably after the Second World War, physicists especially just did an awful lot of consulting for the defense industry, and the defense industry did a lot of funding of academic research. Now, the question with that is not so much the funding as what goes along with the funding. So I don't know the ins and outs of proprietary research, but I can believe that with public-private partnerships or industry funding, scientists might be more secretive about the results of their research. But I also know that industry-funded research, even defense industry-funded research, does get published in the open literature, so it's open. But I'm guessing that, first of all, the industry sort of vets it and says this part is okay to publish. Government-funded research, it depends on what part of the government. If it's National Science Foundation or the National Institutes of Health, it is absolutely, completely, 100% open. It's wide open. Not at all secret. If the government is the Department of Defense or the part of the Department of Energy that runs the nuclear labs, Jason does a lot of work for them, I would guess the same rules apply as with industry. If it's not classified and it's not proprietary in some way, go ahead and publish it.
Does the it's one of these open questions, and I'm thinking of it from a policy perspective at this point, even more so than the law. It would seem that the willingness of the Jasons to work in a schema that was quite different than the academic setting, and you discuss in the book the general atmosphere of sharing information and publishing and getting commentary and that kind of thing, clearly flew in the face of what the Jasons, you made the point that they weren't quite employed by, but the organizations that were asking for Jason's input were looking to achieve. And I'm wondering if an argument can be made that Jason, can, in one way or another, serves to undermine the tradition of sharing information that science has really embraced.
That's a nicely complex question. It's a moral question, and it's wrapped up in the whole business of whether people who normally work on, you know, what holds atoms together and what laws the universe is operating on. What happens when they turn their attention to applied science, when they're working on something like atomic clocks and it turns out that you can make a GPS out of an atomic clock, and then it turns out that if the military buys GPSs that, you know, armies can operate on them. But then it also turns out that Sunday boaters can operate on them and private pilots can operate on them. So the bottom line is, the whole business of the moral implications of scientific research and the associated question of whether scientists have any business working with the military, whose business it is to defend us and to kill other people if we have to, is a call I can't make. And it's not because I haven't asked and watched and thought about it. I've gone on and on and on about it. I have heard non-Jason scientists who know what Jason does, familiar with their studies, say that Jason, in effect, says, well, you know, you shouldn't do this kind of, to their sponsors, you shouldn't do this kind of thing, but since you're going to do it anyway, here's how you do it. These other scientists often say, if you want to maintain whatever power you have with your sponsors, you can't necessarily say what you think. These are non-Jason scientists worrying about what Jason does. By the way, Jasons definitely say what they think. And when I ask them what they think Jason's contributions have been, they mostly say it's stopping dumb programs.
Hmm.
But I did ask, you know, Six Ways to Sunday, if there was something that kept them up nights about what they did at Jason. And the general answer was no, that Masons can work on what they want to work on. So my first reaction to the whole question is that, yeah, it's sort of morally dubious. It's, you know, it's odd. Those lines are going to be hard to draw. And then my second reaction, I get very impatient with the whole question.
Mm-hmm.
Because it does not have a simple and general answer. Just how undefended do you want to be when you're facing, you know, a Hitler, as the Manhattan Project was, or suicide bombers as we are now? And scientists often decide that they are going to work on the pure research, but when it comes to technical applications of their research, which could turn out to be military, they will just stop working on them, and scientists often make that call. But the fact is, it's just a slippery slope, and you don't know what pure research is going to lead to what application, and you don't know if the applications are going to be wonderful or if they're going to be horrifying.
You know, it is a fair point, and I think, you know, there are people that certainly take a dim view of academics and academia because their perception is that you decided to disengage from practical realities, and clearly one could conceive of the situation in academia where someone simply decides that this is a problem that I can't tackle and won't tackle, and I'm not going to make these tough decisions. I'm simply going to disengage. And in fact, you talk about a few individuals who may have done just that in their decision not to be involved in Jason. So it's clearly a moral quandary, and certainly I think one can be commended for attempting to take it on in an honest way. And I respect the fact that it's given the limited format of radio that we can't get into a deep, long-winded discussion of all the moral implications, of the issue. But it is interesting to me that, even having written a book of this length and obviously done the intense research that you've done, that there, you still don't think that there's a clear answer to the question. That says a lot to me right there. Let me turn to, in the time we have left, to this corollary issue that you mentioned a few times. There's a thread in history of individuals and entities whose best work is done in total secrecy. In other words, people have a public perception based upon what they know, and they form their judgments based upon that information, when in fact, if they knew the full story, they might have a very different view. And this is something that goes back to, the dawn of time, really. I get the sense that you would think that Jason falls into that category of people and organizations that, were we to get the complete picture, we would have a quite different view. Or am I wrong about that?
Well, first of all, I think I'd like to know more about what you have in mind, or who maybe you have in mind.
You know, I'll give you examples that I'm thinking of. There have been a number of books written very recently about people working in the covert fields, in intelligence and what have you. And what you find in reading these books that have, you know, that again have been intensely researched, but also suffer from the logical limitation of not having complete information, is that at the time these individuals were attacked for whatever they had done that became public, what wasn't known by the public was that they had done things that were quite the opposite, and that they were being used as tools in ways that only a handful of people could know. And obviously this is continuing to this day, and it will probably continue to the dawn of time. So I'm thinking more of people that are like operatives in the intelligence world, who, you know, when you watch the movies and you see in the cliche of every movie involving a spy is the boss saying, "We're gonna disavow you if you exist." But the truth is, in reading some of these books like See No Evil, the recent book about the CIA, you get the sense that there are a lot of people operating in this dual world. And I'm wondering whether Jason falls into that analogy to the covert operative.
Yeah, it would be an analogy. But yeah, I kind of think so. And especially during the Vietnam War, because they were public, and the whole country was anti-war, and certainly the universities were, and certainly a lot of the media was. And Jason just, you know, they looked like the devil. They were just, their name was Mud. And they, well, let me answer the question in a slightly different way, since I already talked a lot about Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I went into this book as, I'm not that keenly interested in politics, and I don't have any keen political affiliations or even leanings, but if I have leanings, they're definitely left. And I have always been interested in the Faust story and in the uses of curiosity and how it can be used badly. And so I was thinking that this was going to be more of a moral story in that way than it was, that, and that I was going to find the Jasons were a little, had their hands dirty a little bit. And the more I found out about the Jasons, the more it just, that whole thing, that whole attitude seemed so simplistic and so, I don't know, unworldly. You know, it's not how the world operates. It's more complicated than that.
Right, right.
So that's my real answer.
Yeah, and I think it comes out. I think it comes out in your book. I mean, clearly, what I think that one of the, if I were to take a particular lesson from reading the account of the Jasons, it's that one, if they're going to engage in thought about the applied uses of their work, that they must be fully versed, or at least as versed as possible, in the political realities. And you tell really story after story of situations where, as you mentioned, the Jasons weren't plugged in the right way or didn't anticipate a different use. And in fact, you tell the very humorous story at the beginning about the individual who was interested in aging and thought it meant the biological version of aging, when in fact it was aging of warheads.
Right.
So which I think is a great parable for this intersection of the political world and pure science. You mentioned applied science, and I do want to touch on that in, we only have about 5 minutes or so, and so I apologize, and I'll just cut right to the chase.
Okay.
Applied science is something that historically was viewed dimly by many scientists. And I'm curious to get your sense of the question in a different way. You talk about Oppenheimer's phrase, technical sweetness, which I'll let you define. Is this a version of applied science that focuses more on technical sweetness, or was there still in the Jasons that you came across this feeling that applied science was something they had to be a little careful with?
Technical sweetness it's a beautiful phrase. It's become kind of a catchphrase. Oppenheimer used it. I'm trying to remember, but I think during testimony, when he was talking about not wanting to work on one of the bombs, but it was so technically sweet. I mean, the physics was so beautiful, and the working out of the physics in the real world in the bomb was just sweet. It was just beautiful. That feeling of technical sweetness, where you've got an idea and it works out in the real world beautifully, that is nearly universal in scientists. You're not going to get that out of scientists. They just love it. But they're not usually working on bombs, right? So,
right.
So my first reaction to that is, that was a physicist's phrase, you know, he made that up, and they understand that thoroughly. And so to some extent, I'm guessing, like when the Jasons helped invent this very powerful laser that can be used as to help a system of adaptable mirrors so that you can see satellites way above the atmosphere, but you can also see stars way above the atmosphere, that working that thing out was, for them, technically sweet. It was that kind of thing where you start with a lovely idea and it works out beautifully in reality. I am guessing, however, that an awful lot of the stuff they do has none of that for them at all. That I'm going to say that probably on the whole, they're not operating on that motive.
So I hesitate to close on a dark question, but I feel compelled to do it because you close the book in discussing some of these issues of biological warfare. And I guess I would be remiss in not asking about this, especially in light of the anthrax attacks a few years ago and what have you, and obviously what's happened since then. So what's your sense of what Jason is doing in that realm, and where's the locus of this biological research as far as you could tell?
Well, they don't, like, set up a program of biological research and work on it. They respond to questions that are asked of them, and they had quite a few of those questions. But the questions are like, how easily can you genetically engineer something, some microbe that is not lethal, to be lethal, you know, and used in biological warfare? Or how can you set up a system to protect the city against somebody in a crop duster spreading anthrax? How can you even find out if the city's been attacked with anthrax? So it's questions like that. And I can actually sort of go back to the other question you were asking, which was essentially about their motives, whether they were operating from motives of technical sweetness. And I said, not particularly, but I think what is universal in Jason is, and this is very old-fashioned, and uncool to say this, but I think they're really operating from motives of patriotism. I think they think that their country has done well by them, and often their country has done very well by them, getting them through superb schools. And they feel like they owe something back. And they have the knowledge. I mean, I don't have any knowledge that my country can use, so I don't feel particularly patriotic about what I can do for my country, but they have it, and I think if I had it, maybe I'd feel differently about it.
Well, it's certainly I will pat you on the back a little bit and say I think this history has done something for the country in the sense of understanding a part of our scientific legacy that was unknown. So I could commend you for that, and say that I think you've written a fascinating book here. And I'm curious to know, is there a follow up or is there what is your next project, if you want to mention it? What can we look for down the road?
Well, I would love to mention it, but it's in the proposal stage, and I haven't gotten a contract to do it yet.
Fair enough.
But
fair.
It's back off on my first love, which is cosmology. It's leaving these secrets and these you know, classified things, leaving them to one side and moving on.
Well, I certainly look forward to seeing what comes in the future. And I want to thank you for being on the show today and for taking the time to discuss your book, The Jasons.
Well, I've had a lot of fun, and thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.
I want to thank Anne Finkbeiner again for being on today to discuss her book, The Jasons, The Secret History of Science's Post-War Elite. I am looking forward to having on in the near future Frank Pasquale, professor of intellectual property law at Seton Hall University, discussing the regulation of search engines. And additionally, I'm looking forward to speaking to Henry Chesbro, professor at Berkeley Business and author of the book Open Innovation. So you've been listening to Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine, resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. I encourage you, of course, to both check out the CIS webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. The show is also, as many of you know, because you're probably listening to it there, is podcast on iTunes, and I'm also putting the audio up on the CIS webpage. So I thank you for listening today. Stay tuned for more music programming on KZSU, and have a great day.